episode number 80 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm Jeffrey Zeldman, your host, and my guest today is the amazing and incredible John Gruber, a person who needs no introduction, but I'll do that anyway right after this sponsor break. This episode of The Big Web Show is sponsored by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. Start your search at Shutterstock.com to find the perfect image for your website, ad, publication, or any other creative project. You know, John, Shutterstock.com gives you a global image collection to find images from across the world to suit your project. Choose between image packs and monthly subscription packages, or if you just need one image for your blog or mock-up, you could do that too. Sign up for a free browse account. Go to Shutterstock.com, no credit card needed. When you find the images you like and decide to purchase, use offer code BIGWEBSHOW1. That's BIGWEBSHOW, all one word, all caps, BIGWEBSHOW number one, numeral one. BIGWEBSHOW1 will get you 30% off any package. And speaking of packages, we are here today with a man who dominates blogdom and Apple blogdom, a hero of a lot of listeners. John, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Well, I got
to
tell you, I don't feel like any of that is true.
Really? Okay. Well, we'll get
maybe
to,
that's just me.
We'll figure out what's true. So we'll all continue to snow you with this. There are people, I think with younger people who haven't followed your whole career, right? You've just always been there the way like CBS is there or Mozart or Charlie Parker. It's just something that existed for all time. John Gruber's just been this voice of Apple with this gray website, with this look and feel and this tone of voice. But that's not really true. You started like anyone else. So for the younger listeners, if you will, tell us what you studied in school and how you, you know, what you first, your first work experience before you began doing what you do now.
Well, I went to Drexel University in the end of the 90s, mid 90s, I guess. I guess I was there from like 91 to 96.
And Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, right here. I studied and earned a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science, which is a fancy way of just saying programming. One of the best things about Drexel is that they call it a co-op program, but in other words, it's like a mandatory internships for 3 summers. Where you go to school for 6 months and then you get a real job, you know, for 6 months. And the thing that I thought was great about it was that doing the internships with these programming jobs, I realized well before I even graduated that I really didn't want to be a programmer. And the other thing I did there that was inordinately influential on me is I got involved with the student newspaper.
Before you go on, what was the problem with programming? Why was it not for you?
I just did found that when I went to a job, when I went to, you know, 8 hours a day, I was miserable just sitting there doing programming. I don't know.
That's a great benefit to an internship.
Yeah. I just found that, you know, and I got like depressed thinking, oh my God, as soon as I graduate, this is what I have to do all the time. It's a rare self-awareness. I don't know. Just thought it just didn't make any sense to me that if I wasn't enjoying this, that I shouldn't do it.
That's okay. That shows initiative.
I think what ended up happening too is the realization that I really enjoyed tinkering with programs and stuff like that on my own, which is, hey, I have an itch. I want to make this thing for myself. I really enjoy doing this. I'm not saying I'm a particularly good programmer, but I actually don't think I am, but you know, like later on, I went on to make Markdown. And that was just because I wanted to use it. I had enormous fun. I spent way too long making it, you know, compared to what I think a good programmer could have done. But I enjoyed every moment of it because I was making this thing for me. It was this idea of sitting down and somebody else is just going to say, here, John, you're working on, this database that does something that you don't care about.
Sure.
My personality is such, I just never have had the aptitude to just sit down and apply myself to something arbitrarily assigned, you know, whether it be a school assignment or a work assignment or whatever.
How did you get through? I totally relate to that, but how did you get through school?
You know, I don't know in hindsight. And I still, you know, I gave you the year. I mean, I'm going to be 40 very soon. It's been a long time. And I, you know, once I got my BS when I was 22 or 23 or whatever I was, I never went back to school. I still have dreams. Very common. Very, very common. Nightmare of mine is that I'm in school, whether it's high school or college. And it's always, you know, it's not quite the same thing, but it's always the same basic theme, which is that there's a big, I don't know, math test coming up and I haven't done any of it, or it's some other course and I haven't even shown up for any of the classes yet. And there's a big exam coming. What am I going to do? Because in the dreams, I'm me now, like 40-year-old John, right, personality wise. And I just don't have the ability to do it. I mean, like, I don't know. When I was younger, I guess I still had enough of a desire to aim to please, you know, my parents and just society. You know, there's enough of a conformist that I just thought, well, if you're going to college, you got to graduate. You know, you got to, you know, I don't know why, but just that's the way it is. If you're going to go, you got to do well.
It's interesting. My daughter's 8 and she doesn't have that desire to please authority figures. I was like, my ex-wife and I we were very proud of not inculcating fear of authority in her. We were very proud of that. But as a result, she kind of has no reason to do well in school. She doesn't, she does what she wants to do. She says, why can't I write this fiction story about this character I made up? And I'm like, you can, but right now the teachers want you to write this nonfiction about puppies. It's like, I don't want, that's boring.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is going to be so great when you're 40. You're going to be so happy when you're 40. But it's tough when you're 8.
Yeah, I think too. I think that's a great trait. I mean, it just isn't a great trait for getting good grades in school.
Yep.
You know, it's you know, and when you get older, you realize. I mean, and if we could do a whole show about the problems with traditional education and the rigidity and the way that sort of try to, you know, the whole thing is based on conformity. But.
Yeah,
I just think the one thing that's obvious, I think, to almost everybody after you get out of school is that success in school has some correlation to success in life, but it is a one small sliver of it, you know. And so I'm not saying that, you know, that like if I were in charge of college admissions, that I wouldn't even look at your high school academic thing. I mean, I think doing well in high school is a very good sign of doing well in college. I'm much more, once you're out of school completely, like when it comes to hiring people, that's where I would be. You know, it's certainly interesting if you did exceptionally well in school, but it is absolutely, to me, not proof of any kind of success afterwards.
I know that at Happy Cog, we don't really look at that at all. And I've never hired anyone because they had a good college transcript.
I can't even begin to list. If you told me that, hey, I've got all this money. I got that, you know, $20 million. We're going to make an app. It's a secret software project. John, we want you to be the leader of the team. You're going to be like what the director is to a movie to this app.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all this money. Go out, get us 10 programmers. And if I just a list of my friends who I think are good programmers, the number of them who either don't have a degree or dropped out of college or never even went to college is, it's just unbelievable.
Or we're philosophy majors or English majors, right, or art history.
Yeah, physics, anything, all over the place. They didn't study a lick of computer science. And then there's, you know, there's guys like Marco Arment, who's a great programmer, who did study computer science. You know, it's certainly,
yes,
it's not like studying computer science hurts you. But
And we love kids, we love teachers, and we love school's a great thing. And for a lot of people, it's a great thing. I enjoyed school, but I enjoyed college because I was able to pick what I wanted to study, and I kind of made my own major. And you know.
Well, and that's how it sort of worked out for me with the school newspaper at Drexel, was that, okay, you know, and that wasn't for credit. It wasn't a course. They don't have a journalism program there. It was just something that that we volunteered to do. But I loved it. I loved every bit of it. And, you know, one thing led to another. It was that I started just by writing op-ed columns, sort of like a very, very, very poor man's 19-year-old Dave Barry wannabe trying to write funny op-ed columns.
For your Drexel newspaper.
Right. And I think I've told this story once or twice before, but it does amuse me. I think it's probably pretty telling to my personality. It was like I got started my sophomore year just writing op-ed columns. I just come in, and if it tells you how old it was, you came in with it on a floppy disk. in nice. I think it had to be either in Word or MacWrite format, and then eventually ClarisWorks was accepted.
Wow!
But you came in with it on a MacWrite file. They took the floppy, they put it in a computer, they copied the file over, and then you'd find out when the paper came out whether it was whether you got it or not. Because I don't even think I had email because I was a computer science major. I don't think that the student body had email yet in 92, or at least most of them didn't. So my column got in and I was so thrilled. Do you remember the first time you ever saw something you wrote in print?
Sure, I do. I had a similar story with the student newspaper and all that, although in my day we had to use typewriters, acoustic typewriters.
It's to this day that my first column that ran in the Drexel Triangle was it was an enormous thrill. And I think I stashed away an embarrassing number of copies of that paper.
Wait a minute. I lost the newspaper sponsor with my first column. It was a humor column, which in itself is so unfunny and such. Like, I had a great editor, Emily Borden, who believed in me, even though I was just a jackass and not very talented. But I wanted to do this. So I wrote like a dream interpretations of people's sexual dreams that was sort of, I guess, Woody Allen-ish or something. I don't know. Maybe it was funny. I don't know. I was cracking up my girlfriend and her girlfriends and our other friends. So they thought it was funny. So and anyway, this dry cleaner quit. He had been an advertiser with the paper for like 20 years. And he said, I'm not going to have my, I clean clothes. I'm not going to have my clean clothes with this filth. And they were like, it was like, that was almost the end of my journalism career. Like, which like you wasn't a career. And wasn't,
but it's so funny that it was the first one.
It was the first one. And I lost a sponsor instantly. And Emily went to bat for me and kept my, because they wanted to get rid of me. They were like, why did you bring this guy on? He's a jerk. But,
Well, I don't even remember what mine was about. It was just, probably the same type of thing that you had in mind, but it was like trying to be Dave Barry.
Dave Barry.
Just trying to be, it's like take the form of an opinion column and just fill it full of as many jokes as you can. And I think if I went back and read it, I'd be cringing at it. But you got to start out doing, bad work to ever do good stuff. But anyway, second one I submitted ran, and I noticed when I read it in the paper that like halfway through one of my jokes had been edited, and I thought it was changed in a way that made it less funny. And I wish I could remember it. I know I do have them all in a
totally
box,
believe you,
closet. But it just to me took all the piss and vinegar out of the punch of the joke. And I couldn't, I went back to my original and I thought maybe I'd made a grammatical error. Did the way I phrase it, was it against, did I do something wrong grammatically? And I couldn't see how I did. So I didn't understand why they would change it. And it wasn't, whatever the joke was, it wasn't offensive in any way. It certainly wasn't edited for content. Really didn't get it. So when I came in with my third column, I asked the op-ed editor about it. And I said, hey, I just have a question here. And I went and looked at it. And I said, I wrote this, but you guys ran this. And I didn't even say that I thought it was a change for the worse. I just, I just said, what was that? And I remember his name. His name was Francis Wisniewski. And Wisniewski was impossible to spell. Francis. He was a nice guy. And his answer was, the column was one line too long. So I edited that paragraph to get to save a line. And I thought instantly, my first thought was, I can't believe that that's how they edited, why they edited that. And then my second thought was, I need to become the op-ed editor to make sure it never happens again. And then, I didn't push him out. There was a lot of, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of turnover. But I do believe I immediately, by the time Francis left, I was next in line to be the op-ed editor. And the only reason I wanted to be op-ed editor was to make sure that my columns were edited well. And only, and secondarily, so that nobody's columns were edited just to save a line. And then also so that I could always make sure my column got at the top of the page.
Yeah.
But that meant that I had to learn Quark Express. And that started an entire, I wouldn't say a career, but I ended up after college doing an awful lot of print design work in Quark Express. I spent more time in the years, between college and doing Daring Fireball full time. I think I probably spent more time doing print design work than I did doing programming or website development or the other on the other stuff I did.
Where is that now? There's no. I have never once in all the times I've run up, I've met you or seen you speak or read your stuff. I've never once seen like portfolio or.
Yeah, you know what? I don't really have a portfolio. I didn't do anything that I'm particularly proud of. I mean, it was just, you know, either freelance work or, you know, a couple of regular clients, you know, that I had freelance. I was terrible as a freelancer, though. Really, really was. I mean, I was just a bad businessman.
Yeah, it's hard.
Oh, it's incredibly hard. Anybody who does freelance work, to me, my hat is off to you. Because it's always very simple to explain. When you've got an assignment, you're busy because you have an assignment and deadlines are always tight. And if you don't have anything to do, then you're desperate because you've got bills to pay and no work lined up. But while you're working on an assignment, you've got to simultaneously be lining up your next assignment. But if you're a poor organizer of time like I am, you're spending all of your time on the actual work. And so it was this, you know, nonstop feast or famine where I'd be, mm-hmm. you know, oh, I've got, thank God I've got a, you know, here's a, you know, weeks long gig. And then as soon as it was over, it was crickets chirping. And I was like, damn, why didn't I do something 3 or 4 weeks ago to line something else up? Over and over and over again until I learned, don't stop doing that.
Did you consider getting a business partner, just someone who would sort of represent you and bring in jobs while you were doing the job?
It occurred to me when I was doing that ultimately what I would need to do, if this was what I was going to do for a life, that I would have to, you know, form either a partnership with one other person or, probably what happened with you with Happy Cog, you know, turn it into a real business that was more than just a one-man show. There's just, I don't know, anybody who does pull it off as a one-person show I salute you, because it is incredibly difficult.
So you're out of college, you're not washed up as a freelance designer, but again, you're sort of hitting that wall where you're discovering this isn't what I want to do.
Yeah, but I didn't really mind that, though. Like, that's one thing, though, that I really did draw great pleasure from using Quark Express for layout. Yeah. And, you know, and I know people badmouth it now, but I thought in the 90s, I thought Quark Express was one of the best apps I've ever used. I really do. I thought it was just wonderful. It was so fast, you know, did so many. And to me, like in the way that that people draw pleasure from doing like crosswords or Sudokus and stuff like that, which is just, you know, like a way to occupy your mind and people enjoy it. Like typesetting, like getting, you know, here's this article. We need you to fit it in this space is to me like a puzzle that I found enjoyable.
Yes. I used to do collages just for pleasure when I was like, you know, out of school, but had crummy jobs, and design was kind of like that at first. There's a certain level of design where it's almost like a mindless pleasure.
Right. And print design has a level that web design doesn't, where web design, because the page isn't set in a certain size, you know, some of the aspects are similar. I mean, there's obviously some fundamentals of aesthetics that are the same no matter what, you know, whether it's the screen, the web, an app, or print, that's the same. But there's this specificness to the print where you have to fit it on the page, and the page is constrained. It's exactly 11 by 17, I think was the newspaper at Drexel. And so if an article goes one line too long, you can't just stretch the page like you do on the web. And so to me, that solving that puzzle, making things fit and make them fit in a way that was aesthetically pleasing, I always thought one of the best jobs to have in the world would be to do the front page of like the New York Times. Like to be the designer who's, you know, the editors come in and say, here's our articles that we've decided for the front page. And, you know, here's the most important. Here's the other ones. I always thought that like designing the front page of a big broadsheet like the Times, man, what a great job that would be. Every day, something new.
You'd be like, you'd just have done the perfect balance. And then they'd be like, whoa, France just blew up. And you'd be, damn it. I just got it right.
And I'm sure that happens a lot. And it's probably frustrating if you really had something that you liked before. Uh, But in another, you know, but it's like a game. I don't know that it's kind of fun to have stuff happening at the last moment and you have a deadline. I always like that part of doing the school newspaper too. The fact that, you know, on the, we were a weekly, but, you know, we did a production on Thursday nights and then the paper came out on Fridays. But if something happened on Thursday, that was great. It was like, wow, what are we going to do? We've got to blow up the front page.
Yep.
So then I got out of college, and long story short, the fact that I had real-world Quark Express experience, it ended up that that was actually very lucrative as like a temp, like to do, you know, like there are temp agencies where you could hire designers. And the kids who went to art school were no good at using the actual apps because they didn't really learn. They learned, you know, how to make stuff that was aesthetically pleasing, but they never learned stuff like the big tell was, did you know how to use style sheets? Did you set up style sheets? Or did you just select all in the text and use the font menu and change it, you know, change it from 8.5 to 8 or something like that? And all the kids who went to art school were really, really slow because the way it works if you went to art school is you'd get like an assignment and it was like a 3 week, you'd have like a 3 week deadline and you'd spend all 3 weeks diddling with it until the end and then you'd turn it in. But in the real world, you get like 3 hours and you've got to know things like how to use style sheets and templates and you've really got to know the app in and out. And I did because using it at the newspaper every week, it was an enormous amount of work. Like, I really knew Quark Express. I mean, like, I just, you know, like, I had books. I remember David Blattner had written a couple of really good books on Quark Express. And I'd read them, and I'd learn all this stuff, and then he'd come out with a new edition, and I bought it and read it, and I was like, wow, I didn't learn anything. I knew all that.
It sounds like you miss it.
I do in some ways. I don't know. I do miss print design in a lot of ways. I miss the...
It still exists.
Yeah, but I, you know, well, how am I going to do it, you know? I mean, I'd have to go get like a job. I mean, that's not going to happen, Jeff.
No.
But I did a lot of that. I obviously, by the end of the 90s, being able to do design and having a technical, like a programming background, you know, this thing called the web ended up, that's a sort of a perfect skill set.
Yep.
So, you know, I built people websites and stuff like that. But I didn't really do much. There is no secret, you know, backlog of good John Gruber work before Daring Fireball.
But weren't you at a software company? And weren't you there? Didn't you write their technical documents or something? Or is that?
Yeah, no, I worked at Barebone Software, the media edit people, from 2000 to 2002. And that was really, that was actually the only time I left Philadelphia from college through now. I moved up to Massachusetts to work there. And like the funny thing is, like we talked before, I went there and I wasn't hired as a programmer. I think my title was like director of marketing or something like that. But pretty much I was like a jack of all trades. I did customer support. I helped write the manual on the mailing list for customers, which were like, you know, back then it was like what forums are today. I'd help answer questions and write scripts for users. Like AppleScript. To drive the, you know, BB Edit, or at the time, Mailsmith, they had an email program that was really pretty good. But, you know, long story there. But
again, you were able to do it because it was fun for you. It was something you chose to do.
Right.
Like, I'll solve this with a script. I know, I'll solve this with a script, right? It wasn't like someone said, go write a script for all our users, because then you would have balked at it.
And I enjoyed stuff like just writing an answer on the mailing list that, you know, was more or less the equivalent, maybe like the early equivalent of a Fireball article on, you know, how to do something advanced with BB Edit or something like that.
What did you like sharing your expertise? Did you?
Yeah, I like explaining stuff. I do. Why? I feel like that's one thing I used to do more on Daring Fireball that I've gotten away from, and maybe I'll try to steer it back in that direction.
But. You still do it. Just a couple of days ago, you were talking about how to make retina-friendly fave accounts.
Yeah, yeah. And that's exactly – I found that super satisfying. And then I really, really enjoy – because I'll tell you, the first thing I did, and you know, everybody does the same thing. I thought, all right, I got to get a retina fave icon. So I Googled for it, and it's like nothing. There was like nothing that was good that came up except for like one – thing by Thomas Fuchs. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. you know, who's got like a whole ebook on retina stuff for the web. But when I followed his directions, the color got all botched. I don't know. It was this web-based tool that he recommended. And I thought, all right, there's got to be some way to do this. And I spent, I don't know, for something as silly as a fav icon, I spent an embarrassing amount of time on it. But then I thought, I don't want anybody else to ever have to waste all this time just figuring out how to do this. I'm going to write this up. And hopefully Google, you know, I'll give it a title that'll be good for Google and nobody will ever have to worry about this again. And I find that very satisfying.
Yeah.
That there's, and then when people write to me like by email or on Twitter and they're like, hey, I saw your fav icon article. I'd been putting it off myself. I just did it. It took me 5 minutes and now my website has a five. That makes me so happy. That's the happiest I've been in months, is the fact that my article, that stupid article on fav icon, saved a lot of people a lot of time.
It's nice.
And it is great. It just makes me happy.
And again, I find what you're saying relatable because I have a sort of a similar, although like you, I haven't been doing how-tos much lately. I still have people come up to me and say, your book taught me such and such, or thank you. I love that. I love that I was able to help. And then people run with it and they're much better. They're much better than I am. But they take the little bit that I gave them and they run with it. And I like that.
Right. It's that whole standing on the shoulders of giants thing where if you figure out something and it took you a long time to figure it out, you know, whether it's, you know, working around one specific CSS edge case, something, anything. But if you can share it in a way that people find it, then nobody else has to spend time on that problem. And then they can spend time on some other problem and hopefully document it and, you know, everybody's better off.
So there's that aspect of what you do. There's sharing knowledge, but there's also making it entertaining, being passionate about it, making people care about it, sharing that passion. Where does that come from? What's the secret of that in Daring Firewall? Because, you know, no offense, but you write a very interesting blog about what are potentially very boring subjects, right? If in someone else's hands, the same material could be extremely boring.
Yeah, I can't explain it. And I think I'm just fortunate that the stuff that I'm interested in seems to be interesting to an awful lot of people, you know, certainly not mainstream. It's certainly not something that, you know, typical people, normal people out there have any interest in, but it's like, it's a niche, but it ends up being a surprisingly large niche.
Well, so for people who don't know, you're sort of read by, so there's people who know about Apple, what their friends say. There's people who know about Apple, what they read in the papers. And then there's people who want to actually have a much more insightful understanding of what's going on, and they read you. And how did you become – I mean, nobody's an insider in Apple unless they work there and then they can't talk.
Right.
How did you – is this all detective work? Are you like the Sherlock Holmes of Apple observation? How do you – have so many insights into a company that's so secretive?
I don't know. It comes naturally to me. And it is mostly deductive. And it's, as I've gotten more popular, I certainly do have, I know more people who work at Apple
you have
than
more
I did
access.
When I got started.
Right.
I do. But I don't think, very little of my work though is informed by that, because even the people who I know, even people who I would consider friends, I mean, I think Apple's a very simple company. This is one of my favorite theories about Apple. It's really simple, but it ends up, it's, you know, and this is part of where I get all my material from, is that they're widely and commonly and deeply misunderstood. Not by everybody, obviously, but by many.
Well, what do people think and what's the truth?
Well, one of the things I think they think is that there's a deep, complicated conspiracy within the company of how to keep stuff secret, and that everybody within Apple knows everything that's going on at Apple, and that there's somehow, I don't know, that it's like the mafia or something, and that's how they keep stuff secret. But it's not. The way they keep stuff secret is that people who work there just don't talk about what they're doing, even to each other. If you're working on, you know, Project X within Apple, you only really talk about your work with the people who are working on Project X with you and whoever you're reporting to, and that's it. And everybody just sort of works as their own little quiet team.
And why does Apple do that?
because it works for them. And I think it flattens the hierarchy, and it means that it's an organizational structure that is very easily understood because it is completely based on products. You're working on something that's going to be a product, whether it's hardware, whether it's software. There's no sort of vagueness about what team you're on.
So you're on a team, you're working on a specific product, you don't really pay attention to what other people are working on, and you report directly to the boss, directly to the head of Apple. You don't report to anybody else. There's not layers and layers and layers.
No, there's not. And, you know, and whatever it is you're working on is expected to be end up being terrific. You know, but less than A-plus work.
But how does it all work in an ecosystem? Because if everybody's in a silo, if everyone's in a silo, you know, then if I'm working on iTunes on the desktop and you're working on iTunes in the app for iPad, they may be incompatible. And
I would guess, I actually don't know the specific, and there's a lot that I don't know about what goes on. I would guess that in that case, there is, you know, that I would guess that like with the iTunes, that there's, that's not completely siloed from each other, that iTunes from, and I know specifically.
You think, because sometimes like iTunes and one, iTunes means the store in one place, but it means music in another place, but music means music on my phone, but on the computer, iPhone tunes means music. There is some kind of lack of consistency that does suggest that there's a lot of siloing going on.
Well, I think that's different, though. I think that's more of a naming problem. And I think Apple, almost famously, is not that good at naming things, naming products. Hmm. Or at least, maybe not that they're not good at it, but that they're not scientific about it or algorithmic. That they just go with their gut. And maybe for most of that time, it was, you know, one man's gut, Steve Jobs. And whatever his gut said was the right name, that's the name. Whether it really made a lot of sense or not.
So a 57-year-old man starts to forget things and
forgets
what he called it last week.
I don't know that it's that he forgot. I think it's that it grew, right? So iTunes started as and I think the other thing a lot of people outside company misunderstand about them. Nobody at Apple that I know has particularly long foresight, you know, ahead of, you know, where things are going. I don't think anybody in 2001 at Apple really foresaw what iTunes, quote unquote iTunes, was going to become over the next 10 years.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure that they thought, you know, okay, we'll play music. And I'm sure that they immediately thought, and we should probably sell music. I'll bet that the store was something that they thought of right from the beginning, that we should start talking to record labels and we should sell people these songs. We can do this, you know, we can solve this problem where you can't buy music online. You can only either download it illegally or buy CDs that you don't even need anymore. And I don't think they looked past that. I don't think that, we'll call it iTunes and that's it. And then, like you said, then 5-6 years down the line, they're in this situation where there's iTunes, the store, there's iTunes, the Windows and Mac app that does everything because they need it to do all these. It's grown to need it. They need it to do all this thing, you know, to manage everything from iPods to iPhones to apps to backups. And then they've got this new system, iOS on the phone, where they, of course, everybody can see that what a problem it is that iTunes on the desktop is so monolithic. And so they, on the phone, let's do this right and bust it up and just have an app for music playback. We'll have an app for the store where you can go to buy music. And all of a sudden you run into this problem where everything wants to be called iTunes and they can't call it all iTunes.
It drives ADD people crazy. It drives a friend of yours crazy. He like comes out of retirement just to tweet about this in sort of a comical fashion.
Who's that?
San Francisco writer. He's got a book contract for 3 books, but he's not going to write them. Mutual friend.
I know exactly.
But he's written these like rage-filled but hilarious tweets about these inconsistencies, like it's a crime against nature.
It's just one of those things where it's evolved, and it evolved in a way where the needs, what they needed to build software to do, just didn't fit within the naming structure that they'd picked already.
Right.
I always thought it was weird when the iPhone first came out, where like their first solution at this problem was to use the name iTunes for the store app, and they called the music playing app iPod. Like, I forget when they switched that. I think it's about halfway. Like, the first 3 or 4 years of the iPhone, the music app was called iPod. And then they've switched it to be called Music. And one of the reasons they had to switch it was that on the iPod Touch, it was always called Music because the device was called an iPod. How could you have an app called iPod? And it right. just shows how the whole thing was just like...
They're not monolithic.
Like right. said.
They're interaction designers figuring stuff out bit by bit.
Right.
Why do you think there is a... Among some folks in the web community and the standards community or the open standards community, there's this hostility toward Apple. Why do you think that is? And do you think they're right or wrong?
Well, I think it varies. And it's one of those things that just happens to have come up again, I think recently. And, you know, I don't try to concern myself overly with Apple's stock price. I, for one thing, I personally don't own any Apple stock just out of this reason that I think me owning it would, you know, it's the reason that newspapers don't let writers own stock in individual companies is that it would create an enormous conflict of interest, I think. So I don't own it. So I don't have any real financial interest in it. And I do, I think the stock market is so irrational that it's kind of useless. I think, you know, to study it on a day-by-day basis. It's only in the long run that the stock market makes any sense. But recently, Apple stock to me has just been absurdly battered in the stock market. It's lost like 30% of its value in the last 3 months on no actual bad news. It's like misconceptions. It's very deeply misunderstood. So investors, I think, have a very wrong-headed this isn't quite an answer to your question, but investors, a lot of them have misunderstand Apple deeply. In the standards community, in the geek community, I actually think a lot of the antipathy towards Apple is because they do understand Apple, right? So I think investors have it wrong because a lot of people, they're not geeks. And what they really want is for Apple to make sense to them. They want Apple to be like other companies. Whereas Apple's whole success is because they're not like other companies. Right. And that sort of unconformity doesn't fit in their heads. Whereas with geeks and nerds and like standards people, I think it's that they do get Apple. And it's just that for a lot of geeks and nerds, the way Apple works and what Apple stands for, it's just contrary to the way they see technology working. And they see it as almost dangerous in terms of the fact that Apple's vision for technology is very much under Apple's control.
Right.
And it's that control that really bothers people. So
it's
actually
not the commons.
Right, exactly. And it's not consensus driven. It's not community driven. It's, you know, it's what they say goes.
Anyone who's worked with committees and consensus knows how frustrating that can be. Or you've only to, you know, if you look at the U.S. Congress, you can see how difficult getting anything done when there's supposed to be consensus can be.
Right. And, you know, and I think it would be a lot worse. I think one of the things that's calmed it down in web standards, let's take mobile web, right? Apple clearly dominates the mobile web, and specifically what dominates is WebKit. You know, I think WebKit's position in mobile is every bit as dominant as IE's position was on the desktop web development back in the 90s.
Agreed.
When the whole web standards thing really came about. And it was that dominant position of one player that got everybody so fired up for web standards. Surely everybody who listens to your show knows the basic story. And it's, you know, and I think it's right. I don't think there's any reason for people not to be concerned that one web rendering engine is so dominant in mobile. But I think that Google's success with Chrome and now with Chrome for Android has helped temper that, because WebKit isn't as monolithically under Apple's control as IE was by Microsoft, because WebKit's open source and it's allowed Google to sort of keep it going in parallel. I mean, I would be, I'm sure that if we could survey listeners of the Big Web Show, wouldn't you think that more of them would say that on the desktop that Chrome is their favorite browser? I would bet Chrome would come in. And if not, it would certainly be competitive.
Yep, I agree.
And that's a good thing. And it's, you know, it is, and it is rare. It's actually, I think Apple doesn't really get a lot of credit for Apple's not really known as a big open source company, but here's their biggest open source project, WebKit, and it's really been a huge success.
Yes. But yeah, I remember being astonished when they didn't go for the Gecko rendering engine, Mozilla.
Oh, everybody thought so.
We all thought that's what they were going to do, and in some way, by their not doing that, and then by their success with the iPhone and so on, they haven't really killed Mozilla, and Mozilla's not dead, but they sort of started squeezing it into it. It stopped being the great hope of the anti-Microsoft people. Do you ever think that Microsoft is now sort of the standards underdog?
Definitely.
And that Google and Apple are kind of the companies that people are afraid of, the potentially evil companies?
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt about it, I think, because Microsoft's continuing success, and they are. I mean, that's one thing people forget about Microsoft, is that they are still quarter after quarter after quarter extremely profitable. It's a very, very strong company in terms of just finance. But those profits keep coming from Windows and Office. And it's these, you know, which are, I don't want to say ancient. I don't want to be disparaging towards it, but they're like established products. They're not new. It's not innovative. It's not, it's just this.
It's like television.
Yeah, exactly. It's just there and it's established. And, you know, in terms of all the new stuff, they're definitely the underdog. I think, you know, it's very, very clear.
I mean, they're doing interesting things too.
Very much.
And not getting credit for it.
No. And it somehow, and it's, to me, it's one of the biggest mysteries of the world is how something new gets traction. And once you have traction, everything is so much easier. It's so much easier to grow if you've got any traction. And if you don't, and like Windows Phone is to me a perfect example of a product that just has no traction.
But it's a great product. It's a great product. It seems to me that the problem is Microsoft doesn't have brand permission from its loyal installed user base to be innovative. It has brand permission to keep evolving the basic thing. Apple, and you've written about this, Apple will say, you know what, we're not going to be forward compatible. If you bought the Power Computing clone, sorry, we're not going to support it anymore. If you have a SyQuest drive, it's not going to work anymore. And that's, you know, we're changing the pin that you use to sync your phone. And there's going to be a little pain with that, but we think we're doing it for a good reason. I mean, they're constantly doing that, and they're constantly sort of invalidating some hardware purchase you've made. Not necessarily to be evil and force you to buy more hardware, but just because their design process, that's how they iterate their design process. And Microsoft is more like, you know, you can use this ancient motherboard, and do you know what I mean? Microsoft has this long tail or this like string of corpses sort of tied to anything they do. And so when they come out and innovate and they're really new and powerful, their public, loyal public can't make sense of it.
I think that's a great way to put it. I really like that brand permission thing, and that, you know, people who've gotten on board with Apple have gotten on board with their eyes open, knowing that stuff's going to change, right? And so when the iPhone came out, and yeah, it was based on OS X, but nothing was the same. You know, you can't run Mac apps on an iPhone or iPad, and vice versa, you can't. And there's all sorts of other rules that are changed, and you know, user interface and layout wise, and everybody just got on board with it immediately. Whereas, with Microsoft, where they did, when they did have a success in mobile, you know, before the iPhone, with when they called it Windows Mobile back in like the BlackBerry era, it was with this interface that was, you know, had a start menu. It was, you know, like a little mini version of desktop Windows. Mm-hmm. Which is really, I think in hindsight, everybody kind of agrees is the wrong way to go for mobile design. But that's what made sense to Microsoft customers, though, is let's just make it exactly like Windows as we know it, and we'll just put it on a 3-inch screen.
So let me ask you, where there's one way the internet is going toward these sort of very rich, deep application environments like the iPhone, and which, you know, it's constantly leveraging the internet in different ways, right? You know, where am I now? I'm using this map. I'm using a third-party map, Google's map, or Apple's own map to see where I am, and I'm using geolocation and all this stuff. But it's still, it's leveraging the internet within a very, within a closed product under Apple's total control. And then there's this other thing where this explosion of devices, including immobile devices like the TV. You said Apple has no idea where the future will be. Do you have an idea what the future will be? Where do you see all this stuff going?
Oh, I have no idea. If I knew, I'd be working at Apple, I guess. I don't know. I'm terrible at predicting the future. I really am. I'm, you know, I think whatever skill I have is in describing and understanding the present. You know, the future, I don't know.
But you bet on Apple when a lot of people were not.
Yeah, that is interesting in hindsight. And it wasn't really about me thinking, hey, Apple's going to blow up and become huge. It was, you know, when I started the site. And I, you know, it's also the case, though, that I didn't give the site a name that had Mac in the title or Apple in the title or something like that. Because I didn't know. I did have the foresight when I started Daring Fireball to think, I don't know if 2-3 years from now, if that's what I want to write about, is about Apple. Maybe it'll be something else. You know, maybe it'll be, I don't know. I wouldn't know what it would be because whatever it was wasn't out yet. But maybe something else was going to come out and I'd get obsessed by that, right? Maybe in some alternate universe, Apple never made the iPhone and Palm made the webOS, and, you know, that's what became the iPhone of mobile. And maybe I'd be spending, you know, an inordinate amount of time talking about, you know, Palm and WebOS right now. I think if I had been doing Daring Fireball 10 years earlier, I think an awful lot of what I would have written about in the late 90s would not have been about Apple. I think I would have written a lot about what was then the Palm Handspring, Pfizer. Remember those things? The Palm Pilot.
I wasn't too interested in any of that because it was such a crummy experience of the internet. I couldn't take it seriously.
Right. That's what it was. What all those things desperately needed was wireless internet, right? And we didn't have it yet. And so, you know, in hindsight, that's clearly what was holding those things back.
I blogged yesterday. It was a very short post, but with one finger, with my left hand, and I'm right-handed, with my left hand, I pecked out something. I might have, into a phone while I was walking to the gym. I dropped my daughter off at school. I was walking to the gym and I posted something because all this stuff exists now. And when I started blogging, when you started blogging, we had to be in front of a computer with a wired internet connection, which we hoped was working, and all that stuff, and a typewriter keyboard. And it's amazing now. You know, it's really amazing.
It really is. But I really want to emphasize that, though, that when I started Daring Fireball in 2002 and Apple's, you know, I think if you graph their stock price from when I started Daring Fireball to now, it's just amazing. You know, it's one of those things where if you'd put $1,000 in it when I started Daring Fireball, you could buy a house with the money that it's worth now. I take no credit for that. I did not start Daring Fireball mostly writing about Apple because I thought Apple was going to have a decade like they've had. I wrote about Apple then because I thought they were doing interesting stuff for people like me. And I certainly thought there was a huge upside to them in the near term because I thought, boy, this stuff is great. Mac OS X has a lot of problems, but it's coming along. It's going to be really good. You know, I thought that the iPod was, you know, which came out right before I started Daring Fireball, was a really, really interesting take on consumer electronics. And I thought, boy, this seems like the future of consumer electronics. Like the stuff that all of their competitors in this space are doing is so clunky compared to this. So in some sense, I was right in that Apple was doing good work and that there was a market for it, but I certainly didn't predict anything like what's happened.
Well, yeah, there's always the serendipity. Let me ask, where did the name Daring Fireball come from?
I used to be secretive about it, and I guess I don't even know why. That's stupid to be secretive. I've told this story before, too. So when I was very young, I don't know what grade, first grade, kindergarten, something like that, I was it was, you know, late 70s, and Evel Knievel used to have regular specials on ABC, you know, or jump over Caesar's Fountains or try to jump over the Grand Canyon or something. And I loved Evel Knievel. I thought that was America, right? That's just great. A guy on a motorcycle doing crazy stuff. And the first thing that I ever would answer the question, what do you want to be when you grow up, was I wanted to be a daredevil stuntman. I wanted to get shot out of a can. This is my idea. Instead of a motorcycle, I would do like what Evel Knievel does, except getting shot out of a cannon. And instead of just being in a tent in a circus and getting shot into a net, I would do like Evel Knievel and go to landmarks around the world and get shot over them or into them, or, you know, shoot myself into an open window on the 47th floor of the Empire State Building. And I came up with the name Daring Fireball. And I drew little, you know, I have little notebooks. I'm sure my mom has them somewhere, that drew little notebooks with my costume. And the costume was just a complete ripoff of Evel Knievel combined with the Dallas Cowboys. Just starred blue and stars and circles. And I think it was second grade when we had to do like a little, you know, and you know what it's like, because your daughter, I think, is in third grade, right?
Second grade.
Well, you know what the yeah. work that, you know, a report, it seemed like an enormous amount of work to me. But when you did a report in second grade, I mean, in high, you know, it really was like three sentences, if you're lucky. But I had to do a report on what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I went to the library, and they find, and the librarian, they found, it was like a kid's book, but they found a book on like circus performers or something like that. And there was like a page on the guy who gets shot out of a cannon. And I read it, and it said that it's not really an explosion. It's like a spring loaded thing. That's, you know, that's the trick in all these cannons. They're not really, there's no explosion that's, you know, that would kill you if you had like a real cannon. It's a spring loaded thing that shoots them out, but that it's very, very hard on your body because it's, you know, this enormous amount of stress, and that the performers frequently have terrible back problems, knee problems, and that they, and over the course of a brief career getting shot out of a cannon in the circus, you lose about an inch or two in your height because all of the discs in your back compress and you lose all the cartilage in your knees. And I thought, well, that's it for that. I'm not going to do that. But I remember I did the report and concluded, well, hell, I'm not doing that. That's terrible. But I still always thought it was a pretty cool sounding name. And so I filed it away and thought someday I'll have a use for it.
That's a wonderful story. And the logo.
It's just the idea I had when I was, you know, what I would have had on the side of my helmet when I was plotting my career as a stuntman in first grade.
And how did you know to do a content focused, extremely minimalist design that it would hold up very well over time? How did you know that?
I don't know that I knew that it would hold up over time, but I thought that it would. And part of it was certainly driven by, and I'm sure the same is true for you and the designs you've had over the years at Zeldman.com, where a lot of times it was just a reaction against what I was doing for clients, because it mm-hmm. was, you know, I got paid to design and do websites for people, and they never looked anything like Daring Fireball, because they wanted, you know, if you're paying a lot for a website, you want a lot of website.
You want a Clement Mock like design.
You want something that looks like there's a lot of design. I don't know.
A lot of graphics, a lot of bevels.
Right. And boxes and stuff like that. And I've always, you know, so it was a reaction against that. And, I've always been a fan of minimalism. I just think that that's what stands up. And I've always had.
Are you afraid about, I mean, nowadays with the higher, with the screens are bigger and the densities are tighter, and it's a little hard to read. It can be hard to read in some contexts. Have you thought about?
I'm due for a gentle redesign. I mean, there's no reason even to be secretive about it. I mean, I don't plan on changing the colors, and I don't plan on changing the basic gist of what it looks like.
Nor should you.
11px Verdana. I picked the font 11px Verdana back in 2002.
Because it looked great aliased non-anti-aliased.
The vast majority, I mean, Mac OS X was already out, but the vast majority of my readers were on Windows at the time. I think it was like 70% Windows. And then on a Mac, it took at least 2 years before Mac OS X overtook Mac OS 9 as mm-hmm. the most common thing that people were using. And on Mac OS 9, the fonts weren't anti-aliased. Mm-hmm. So it was picked to look good then. And that it looked kind of good anti-aliased, you know, it's just sort of been, what would you call it?
Attribute to the type designer.
Oh, it's a great
right, Matthew type Carter. That when we made this huge leap from non-anti-aliased to anti-aliased, that it still holds. Georgia and Verdana still look good. That's
same,
amazing.
Same for both of them. Yeah, that's very amazing. True. And that all these other fonts that look good now look. There's no other fonts I can think of that's true for. I mean, Helvetica used to look awful, just awful on screen. I mean, it's always been a beautiful typeface for print, but on screen before anti-aliasing, my God, it was just...
You couldn't use it.
It would hurt. It really would hurt hurt you to look at it.
If you looked at it on Linux or Windows, like, it was horrifying.
The fact that Daring Fireball hasn't yet switched to using web fonts and like a responsive layout that's optimized for the phone is probably a sign that I'm getting too old and too...
You don't necessarily need to switch to web fonts, but responsive might be nice.
Well, responsive is crazy because, I mean, you wouldn't believe how many of my readers are on the iPhone and iPad. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Daring Fireball is, it's not quite most, but it's up there. I mean, I don't know if I can look it up here or not, but I think it's at least like 30 to 40% of my traffic comes from the iPhone and iPad. And it's not, especially on the phone, and, you know, one of the worst things, I think, the thing that's really hurt me, set it back the most, is that just by sheer coincidence, I only have this one layout that's meant really for the desktop. But if you load it on the iPhone, it's not bad. Right. And you do the double click thing, and it's, you know, it's actually a pretty reasonable text size and a pretty good column width. I think that the fact that it's actually pretty good for a non-optimized for mobile website has set it back because if it
held
was terrible,
you back, right? Yeah, it removes the urgency.
If it was really bad, I would have had to do a mobile version years ago, and it would be like perfect for it. It's overdue. It'll happen this year, but it won't. You know, won't change dramatically. As for the fact that it has held up, I don't know. I guess it's a luck. I don't know, but I also think though that the simpler you make something, the more likely it is to hold up. You know, that the more complicated something is, the more likely it is that you're going to use elements and make choices that are trendy rather than timeless.
Well, this has been a timeless show. I want to thank you for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And your voice is like, it's like butter. I can't get enough listening to Jeff Zuckman's voice. You know, and on podcasts, voices are like fonts, right? Font is to reading, your voice is to a podcast. And to me, your voice is like, I don't know, it's like Garamond. It is like, wow, that is, I could just listen to that all day. Like, I would like to listen to books read by you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I hope we'll do it again sometime.
Yes, absolutely.
And have me on your show.
I should.
Okay.
I will.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.